Environment, Economic Development, and Agricultural Division for Monday, February 23rd, 2015 will come to order. Commissioner, welcome to the committee. If I'm not mistaken, this will be a little bit different than the other people that we've been listening to, in that you're reducing fees, if I'm not mistaken, in this budget, as opposed to raising fees. So that's pretty interesting. So he's probably tricking us somewhere, but I'm not sure. So, anyway, go ahead, Commissioner. Just say your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Ken Peterson. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry. And in reference to the Chairman's remarks, we're very happy to talk about reducing some fees in just a minute. What I'll do is quickly give an overview of our department, and then I don't know if we hand this thing out.
No, we all got it.
Just get a quick overview of the department, less than 5 minutes or so, and then talk about the changes, and so we can cover things. What the Department of Labor and Industry is basically regulates workplaces and does code and licensing work. First division on the chart, the sheet you have there, the Workers' Compensation Division, the oldest division in the department, and it has 121 FTEs, and its budget is $10.5 million. It's I think Minnesota's workers' compensation system is working pretty well. I think most of the national ratings put us, our fee or our premium, somewhere in the middle of the range, and our performance, our getting back to work, getting people back to work from being injured, is best in the country. What the division does ensure that appropriate benefits are delivered to injured workers quickly and at a reasonable cost. And we try to create an environment where injured workers promptly receive benefits and services. We do different performance measures. 82% of mediated workers' compensation cases are resolved by DLI mediators. One of the things is about 20% of workers' compensation cases end up in disputes. 80% don't, but 20% do, and we try to resolve it as quickly as we can. Second number there, as I'll talk more about this in a minute, workers' compensation benefits paid annually by second injury and supplemental benefits of $48 million. But those two benefits are benefits were done away with during the 1990s and some workers' compensation reforms, but we're still paying down on them. And I'll explain in detail the budget amounts those are in a minute. The next division we have is Minnesota OSHA, and that helps make Minnesota's workplaces safe. Minnesota's a state plan state. The right half of states have state plans run by the states. The federal government pays half, and we pay half. It's funded out of the workers' compensation assessment. And we have 92 employees in two divisions. One's called compliance. One's called consultation. What consultation does is go out to the workplaces, and hope mostly small workplaces, less than 250 employees, and tells people what they can do to avoid a workers' compensation penalties and how they can fix up their workplace. Compliance is the one that goes out and does fines. And we are reducing our fatality rates. They're still too high. Everyone's too many, but now we're down around 50 to 20 a year. And you can see 96% of our safety consultations are conducted with small employees. We do about 2,500 inspections are conducted annually. However, the federal government has cut back on their spending, so we've cut back. So now we're down to around, this year it'll be around 2,100 to 2,200 of inspections. Labor standards is our only division that's paid for out of the general fund. That's the one where you call, you're not getting your paycheck, or some issue over a wage and hour dispute, you call us, we help you out. That enforces minimum wage, also enforces prevailing wage issues, and child labor. And it is, its budget's $1.3 million a year. We have 14 people work there. And some of the performance measures you can see, 73,000 employees last year were served by the program, and the wages recovered for employees was $870,000.
Do you have enough people working there?
That's always been we're not asking for more people in that division, but it's always been a problem, Mr. Chairman, because it's the only general fund section of our department, so whenever there's a down years, there's always the area that gets cut. We do have 14 now. I'm asking for people in our apprenticeship division. We're not asking for people in the labor standards division this year.
Are you asking for more general fund money?
No.
You want it?
The governor's not requested it, Mr. Chairman. The next division we have to discuss is apprenticeship. It's paid for out of the workforce development funds. We have 7 FTEs there, and I think you're all familiar with apprenticeship. That's the program that what it tries to do is sort of like an alternative to college. You go there, you work and learn at the same time from somewhere between 2 to 4 to 5 years. In 2011, as we came out of the recession, we had like 4,500 apprentices, maybe a little less. Now we're at 9,100, I think. And about 80%, 85% are in the construction fields. We're trying to increase the apprenticeships in other fields, too. We think it's a great program. We think that apprenticeship is a way to go for a lot of people. It's not for everybody, but it's certainly a good program for people in manufacturing and healthcare and some other fields, as well as construction.
Commissioner, a quorum is present. Okay, go ahead.
Last year, the percentage of new apprentices that were women and minorities was 28%. The next,
Is that a higher number or a lower
number?
Yes,
it's higher. It's much higher. We've really gone up. Construction has been an area we've really tried to increase the number of minorities and women, particularly minorities. We've made an effort. I think something like it was 11%. In 2011, and now it's 18% of all apprentices are in the construction fields are minorities. So we think it's one way we can shorten, close this disparity, wage disparity gap we're having, at least with some people, and give people a good middle class life. If you finish an apprenticeship program, you got a certificate that says you can do a job and you can do it any place in the country. It's transferable. It just says you're qualified to do this, and you have people that have. Watch it. So we're recognized by the federal government as a federal apprenticeship agency, and there's been a lot of interest in apprenticeship, both at the federal level and the state level. You funded some programs out of this committee that helped out, and I can talk about in a minute. Our next area is construction codes and licensing, and we license contractors, electricians, plumbers, pipe fitters, boiler operations. We also do building codes, the commercial building codes and residential building codes. We do electrical permits. They're the ones that go. You come out to your house when you're building it, and we make sure it's going to be work okay, and give a permit, and then go ahead and finish it up. 128,000 individuals and businesses were licensed in construction-related activities last year, and most of licensed are two-year terms, and we do about 157,000 electrical inspections every year. This area is where we'll come back to that when we talk about our cut. The construction economy has done very well. We've also made some in the last few years, and we've also made a number of efficiency changes that allow for online licensing and renewals of licensing. And that's saved us money, so we want to reduce our fees, which I'll talk about in just a minute. Our final program is general support. And that's supported out of sort of assessment on all the other parts of the department. And our Office of Combative Sports, which I'll be talking about, is also part of that. General support's got lawyers, accountants, human resources, legal services, and that sort of thing. Just the bottom of that page that we panned out is just on the pie graph. You can see the source of our funds. The deep blue is workers' compensation. 68%. That is an assessment that the commissioner makes every year on workers' comp, and then it becomes part of your premium and comes back to the state. That's 68% of our total funding. And most of that goes to those two benefits that I talked about, the second injury benefit and the supplementary benefits, both of which no longer exist, but we have workers who were injured prior the changes in 96 or 95, and so they're still receiving those benefits. The second one, you can see there's a lighter, what is that, purple? Construction codes, 23%. That's all fees generated from licenses as and permit inspections, that sort of thing. The we get the workforce developments, 1%. That funds our apprenticeship division. The contractor recovery fund is just a pass-through. Instead of contractors in Minnesota, residential contractors, instead of having bonds for if there are problems with the homes they build, they put in money up to with us. We assess it, and then if they're sued, we're able, and they get a judgment, they're able to get up to $75,000 from us out of that program. So we assess the contractors, they give it to us, and then it goes out in terms of loss, you know, in terms of judgments we pay to the residential homeowner, the disgruntled, dissatisfied residential homeowner. But Sheery, he's got to get a court judgment to deliver that. The federal funds, which are all OSHA funds, are 4%, and the general fund is less than 1% of our overall budget. And you can see the others was just the breakdown of expenditures, which roughly follow along along the lines of the pie chart. Then I'll go into, if it's okay with you, Mr. Chairman, just go into our the changes, the budget changes. The first one, and probably most significant one, is in our construction codes and licensing divisions, is reduce our licensing fees. We want to reduce reduce each of our licensing fees by approximately $20. This reduces license costs for contractors, electricians, plumbers, high-pressure pipe fitters, boiler operators, and it realigns our licensing revenue more closely to the program cost. As I said earlier, we reduced our costs have been reduced simply by allowing for electronic renewals and that sort of thing. And also, the construction economy is doing very well, so we're making more money than we need. So that's what we think that I'd be giving back. And then, but this will be done on a 2-year basis. We check 2 years from now, and if we can keep it down or reduce it more, we'll come back and do the same thing in 2 years. That's our hope with this one. And if we can reduce it more, we'd certainly like to. We don't want any more money we need to have. The net physical impact is $1.5 million a year. The next one is replace the department's legacy computer system for workers' comp. In 94-95, that the department bought what's called a Power Builder computer system. The problem with that is it was good at its time and still operates pretty well. The problem is it can't take electronic submissions of first reports of injury as well as other things. So everything has to be done. Most things have to be done by mail. So it can take some electronic submissions, but can't take others. So we'd like to replace, and it's also antiquated in other reasons. Yeah. The Power Builder is no longer made by anybody, so we have to hire outside consultants that fewer and fewer people understand it. Last year we brought in a poor man from Texas, and I think he's from San Antonio. And he went through, well, today's a pretty bad day, but last winter, as you all recall, we had like a whole bunch of days like this. And poor man, he suffered. He'd never seen snow before, and he came up here and went through one of the worst winters in, what, 10 or 15 years. Anyway, it's hard to find people to understand this system. And so what we'd like to do is simply replace it, and it'd be funded out of the Workers' Compensation Fund, on the basis of $3 million a year. That's the placeholder number. We put $3 million a year for 4 years. But we don't, this is the problem with it. We don't know what the exact number will be. We have a consultant who's hired, who's going to give us the range of the number by the end of March.
Just the fact that you hired a consultant means it's going to be more.
Get
that guy that was afraid of the snow. Bring him up here. He'll get it done in a hurry.
He left. As soon as his contract out, he got out of here.
Uh-huh. Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The consultant you hired previously didn't help Minsure, did he?
No. Nor the Department of Public Safety. They can't bid on the contract. They're just giving us the cost, what we need. They're looking at buying systems off the shelf or building a new one. And they'll just give us a report, and then they're done. And we're working very closely with Minard on this to come up with the right one. And what once we better know the numbers, I'll ask the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council to approve it. We'll discuss with them, If we have time this year, I'd like to bring it to you, Mr. Chairman, the committee, and just run it by you. If we don't get a good number, we won't bring it in. It'll come back next year.
Well, I would hope you would run it by me.
Yes, we'd have to run it by you. We'd have
okay,
to
right, okay, good. Right.
And have you kick us around as well as the number.
No, we just it's just that we do need some solid numbers on this,
I would
think.
I understand.
Just so we can understand it. It's so with the workers' compensation fund. But so 12 million is just a, we're just going to throw that number out there because we have an indication that it might be that much, or what's?
We have an indication it might be that much, but we don't know for sure.
And it'll take 4 years to do it?
It'll take somewhere between 3 and 4 years to do it. You'd probably put out the bids would go out sometime next fall or winter, or the RFPs, the request for proposals, and then you'd start working on it. And it'd take would like to get it running by 2018, but I'm not sure it will be.
I suppose based on Senator Weber's comment, we should probably get it right, huh?
We want to get it right.
Yeah.
I don't want to have any problems.
Okay, all right, go ahead.
He's in trouble. Yeah.
The next one is a base increase for the workers or the Workforce Development Fund for apprenticeship to hire two new employees for apprenticeship. The apprenticeship, as I said earlier, it's been a widely discussed area. There's been several programs passed by the legislature the last couple of years to encourage more apprenticeship programs, and the national on the national level, people are pushing more. We'd like to have two more people to further develop programs, to work with employers, to work with employers as well as schools to put together apprenticeship programs to accommodate a wider variety of individuals. They'll concentrate on minorities as well as on new fields for apprenticeships.
Is that enough?
Yes. We think that is enough.
And how much do you hope to accomplish?
Did we put together a proposal on that? We're hoping by 2017 to have at least 11,000 registered apprentices up from 9,000 now, and to have 9% females and 25% minorities. That'd be our goal. We think it's a pretty cheap way of doing it. These people just work with employers, and also we're asking for $30,000 a year to for recruiting purposes and for putting on programs in high schools and community colleges to get people interested in apprenticeships.
Is that a 9,000 to 11,000, I guess, is a pretty good gain. And is it, if you don't hit the minority and female numbers, are you still going to go for the 11,000? I mean, there's a possibility you may not be able to get the apprenticeships
in
the places you want them, but...
Yep. We will.
Okay.
Just try to get as many people as we can.
All right.
It's a good program. It works for, we need it more in our rural areas, I think, for in some manufacturing professions as well as others. I think we also need it in our cities with minority populations.
Okay.
The next one is another smaller fee reduction. This is for the Office of Combative Sports. As you know, the labor and industry regulates mixed martial arts and boxing. A couple years ago, we raised the fees, and we raised them too much, and we think that we discouraged some people from getting licenses for boxers for both sports. So we're a total of $4 million for the two years. We reduce them from professional license from $100 to $70 and amateur license from $60 to $50. It's $2,000 per year. It just changed the license fees.
And they govern themselves, right?
Yeah.
And you just battle with, like, Mike Tyson and people like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, battle Mike Tyson. Well, we have one employee, and with the help of a couple others, basically the office, I think, has got a budget around $110,000.
Okay.
And the idea is to make sure that the fights are safe.
Okay.
And then, as with other departments, we're asked for as the governor has asked for, a 1.8% increase, just an operating adjustment, an increase in our funds that are coming out of the general fund, the workers' compensation fund, and the workforce development fund. Does not need to come out of the CCL, the construction codes and licensing fund, because that's the self-sustaining fund. But the other, we would ask for a 1.8% increase from those three funds. And that, Mr. Chairman, completes our request.
Any questions or comments for the commissioner? Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Commissioner Peterson. This is not on your budget request, so I don't know, and I don't know if you have the answer today. Maybe you'll have to come back and talk to me another time. I have a question about the workers' comp fund and the process for determining the experience modification rates that employers pay. And my question is that, so Company Z has an employee claims an injury. The company said he didn't have an injury, but the employee is doctoring. As soon as the doctor's bills start to flow, the department changes the company's experience modification rate to cover those costs, even though there's been no determination of responsibility anywhere. I mean, they're often going to go to some administrative law judge for determination of responsibility, but that's not occurred. So why does the Company Z's experience modification rate change prior to any determination of responsibility of the injury?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, the Department of Labor and Industry does not do the experience modification. That's done by recommendations made by the it's called the MWC, Minnesota Workers' Compensation Information Association. They tell they contact the insurer and tell them. So I'm not quite sure how that works. And if you'd like, I can find out more information before I can get back to you. We don't have. I'm surprised that they would do it that quickly, though. I've not heard that complaint before. I can come back and give you more details on how it works, but I'm surprised.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. Yeah, I would appreciate it if we could visit a little bit, and maybe you'd bring somebody from that agency or that organization who has knowledge about it. It seems to me that what's happening is that it's no longer an insurance plan, but it's simply a financing mechanism. And so as soon as there's any costs that start to occur, the financing mechanism kicks in by raising these modification factors to make sure that there's money flowing out of the employer to pay for the employee's injury. And I would like to have a little further conversation about that mechanism, because it doesn't seem appropriate to raise the cost to the company until there's some determination of responsibility. And once it's been determined who's responsible, then it would be completely appropriate. But before that, I wouldn't think it would be. So I'll look forward to some further conversation.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I agree. I mean, if it hasn't been found, companies liable for the cost of a non-workplace injury or whatever the situation was, there should be no reason to raise their insurance costs.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on to Senator Skoy's point, I actually had some individuals in my office within the last year and a half that were having very similar situations on workman's comp. Example, you've got a 50-year-old gentleman who's been working in the pipe fitting trade. And over time, he's been a safe employee, but over time, obviously, he's developed some chronic conditions just because he's worked in a labor-intensive industry. And what we're finding, or some of these companies are finding, that they're either phasing those people out or their rates are going through the roof, because as you are more experienced and more, frankly, in my opinion, more safe, you actually see your rates go up because they already know that you're going to have some type of a chronic injury because you're going beyond age 50 or 45 or whatever the case may be. Meanwhile, you have a 25-year-old that just starts out and doesn't know all the safety that's involved and can actually be a greater liability because they don't have the same experience package as a person that's 50 years old. I'd actually like to have a conversation with why these companies who are employing good, experienced workers in the workforce that are, like I said, could be arguably more safe than a 25-year-old, but are having to pay astronomical increases in their workman's comp just because of what could happen down the road as opposed to what does happen.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, let's talk. I'm surprised at that, too. they shouldn't be basing their insurance rates on the age of the workers. It should be based on the injuries they're incurring and the possibilities of injuries. So I'm surprised.
Okay. Oh, Mr. Chair.
Senator Osmond.
I'd certainly like to have that conversation. I actually like to bring in a couple of companies, or at least a couple that I have bumped into that are having this type of an issue, because I don't want people discriminated against just because they're getting older. God knows we're all getting that point around here. But I'd appreciate the conversation.
Good.
Commissioner, who governs those rate increases that Senator Osmond and Senator Scoy are talking about?
Mr. Chairman, it's really basically up to the insurance company, or if it's self-insured, it's up to them. But it's up to the insurance company. They'll get the information from the MWCIA.
Does Commerce monitor them? Is that who monitors them?
Commerce monitors the rates that the insurance charge, but the size of the premium is determined by the premium for the individual payer, the individual business, is determined by the insurance company itself, looking at the best information they have. And that's going to, obviously, it's going to vary from insurer to insurer.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know who sets it, but there is a state organization, I don't know if it's an agency or what it is, that sets the experience modification rate. And that's what's driving the premium. And that's what we need to get the information as to why they are changing the experience modification rate based on age or based on injury when the determination has not been made as to who's responsible.
And Senator, that's the MWCIA. We'll get those people in touch with you all. I'll bring them around with me.
Senator,
I'll talk to you.
And also in that vein, these companies that are employing the younger workers are seeing significantly lower rates than companies that have the more experienced older workers, because they know that the older worker package is going to have these, over time, these types of situations. The ones who are employing the younger, less experienced workers see very low rates in comparison, and that's what's causing, what happens then is when they go to bid for projects, there's a significant cost differential, and it's making them, the older, more experienced group, less competitive. So that's the type of direction that I would like to see some conversation on.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I'll take steps to ensure we do that.
Senator Westrum.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, while we're on kind of the discussion of insurance, maybe this isn't timely now, and I'm happy to visit later in your presentation or discussion or another time if it isn't, but self-insured work comp pools. Is there any discussion of reform or at least provisions that work with the parties involved so they're more aware of what the policies require? And the reason I'm asking, I've had some constituents that have, in one case, a spouse taken over a business because her spouse died, and then all of a sudden, 10 years later, or several years later, these work comp pools come back and recover and have given them no notice and paid out injury benefits when they would contest that there shouldn't have been things paid out on their behalf. And if there were, there should have been notices to the companies. But big question, I'm just wondering if there's any discussions you guys have had internally about those situations. And
Mr. Chairman, Senator,
sure.
in terms of, we're always discussing it. I mean, just always ongoing discussions of problems like this that come up in the field. But I'm not quite sure the individual situation you're discussing, if the issue is related to self-insured, where a company simply insures themselves, they're certified by the Department of Commerce whether they have the adequate means to insure themselves,
right.
Or they're affiliated with a group that does self-insurance, or right. They're affiliated with the assigned risk plan. I'm not sure.
The second, on a self-insured pool.
Those are regulated by the Department of Commerce, what they do, but we're always very concerned about their conduct.
I see. Okay. So that's a different department.
Yeah.
Thank
yes.
you.
Yes.
Okay. Any other questions? All right. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you very much. Thank you, members.
Department of Agriculture. Welcome.
Thank you, Senator Tomasoni. Chair and members, my name is Santo Cruz, for the record. Today we've been asked to go through the change items as well as giving a brief overview of the department. I know we've got a little under an hour left, and we've got about five areas to cover, so I'll have Mr. Gear-Frizeau jump right in and come on up and start testifying about the Plant Protection Division and the governor's change items associated with his division.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Senators. My name is Gear-Frizeau. I'm the Director of the Plant Protection Division, and I'm going to go through my slides very quickly. There's a large variety of programs within our division.
No, and then we do names here a lot, so give me a little bit more on his gear.
I'm sorry, your question?
Gear. How do we get...
It's a Norwegian.
Norwegian. Okay. All right. Is it you named after your grandpa or something? Or what?
No, it's an original... there's not many gears I've met, but...
Yeah, exactly.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's named after the tractor.
After the tractor. I mean, we have, like, Commissioner Forrest Bowe is in charge of, you know, the forestry. And
yeah, that was very clever.
Yeah, Ms. Rivers is in charge of the parks and trails. And, you know, so I was just wondering, okay, go ahead.
Mr. Chair,
thank you, Mr.
I think the question is, where did he come from in Norway?
Where in Norway?
I was actually born in Kristiansand, Norway, in southern Norway.
Oh, you were actually born there?
Yeah.
All right. So do you have dual citizenship or
no? No, I'm still Norwegian.
You are?
Yeah.
Got a green card.
I do. Actually, they're pink now. But
pink. The green card was mentioned last night in the Oscars. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, in the interest of time, like I said, I'll move through very quickly. And the first slide I have, it just talks a little bit about the mission of the division, and we are kind of have two general areas. We're trying to protect the environment from plant pests and pathogens. And then we also provide certification services for the movement of agricultural commodities. The first part of my talk, I'm going to talk a little bit about fee-based programs, and just looking forward, we're projecting a balance forward of about $1.6 million, estimated receipts or revenue coming in about $4 million, and then there's a net transfer that goes to the lab basically to support the seed laboratory of about $320,000, and then a balance forward out of $1.3 million. Some of the programs in the fee-based programs include grain licensing, and this provides protection to growers who sell or store grain by requiring that all Minnesota elevators be licensed and bonded and inspected. And we conduct about two checks of grain warehouses each year, and we measure bins to verify the quantities there. We also have a wholesale dealer license program. This protects growers who sell perishable products, fruits.
So is the grain licensing going up?
This is the second one is a wholesale dealer license.
Back to the grain licensing. Is that one going up?
Is the fee
going up? No?
Okay. That remains the same. Wholesale dealer license protects growers who sell perishable products. Again, requires a bond be maintained by those wholesale dealers. So if there's a problem, that the grower is protected. The next program is fruit and vegetable inspection. This is strictly a fee for service. What we do is we provide grading and certification on all fruits and vegetables when we're requested. Basically, this provides... sort of the price point for wholesalers, what they pay to the grower, is based on those grades and inspections that are provided by our agency.
And is that going up?
Mr. Chair, no, it's not. Next.
Hey, when we get the one that's going up, let me know.
Okay.
Just wait.
And that's a good introduction because the next one is seed inspection. That one is one of our change items. We provide inspections for seed marketing and distribution. We require that the seed labels are accurate, correct, and consistent, and we verify the viability and purity of the seeds. And this is one of the four change items that I have at the very end, and it's the one I'll probably spend the most time
Oh, so you have a summary at the end here of everything?
Yes, there's at the very end, there's a
okay. All right, go ahead.
Change items. Very briefly, apiary inspection. We provide inspections of apiary. This is mainly for bees that are being transported to other states, primarily California, for pollination services. We have a potato inspection program with an office in East Grand Forks. We provide shipping point.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quickly, the apiary inspection. How does that? Just take me just through it a little bit as to how that happens. When I have a truckload of bees that I want to go to do some pollinating out in California or wherever I want to go, how does that work?
Sure, Senator, Mr. Chair. If someone is going to another state like California or Louisiana, those states, if they require an inspection to prove that the bees are free of certain pests, you simply contact us. We charge a fee, basically time and mileage, for the inspection. We would go and inspect those colonies, make sure it's free of various pests, and then we would provide a certificate of freedom from those pests.
So just to follow up, so that certificate then will be good in California? They accept that?
Mr. Chair, Senator, that's correct.
Thanks.
Senator Osler. Mr. Chair, there's I've read a report on mites that bees are having issues with, and it's causing collapses of beehives. Can you tell us a little bit about what in Minnesota, if that's currently occurring, or what level is that occurring at?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Senator, there's been two parasitic mites that were introduced in the 1990s. One is a varroa mite, and the other is called tracheal mite. And they were both brand new to the United States, and they really have been quite devastating to the bee industry. And they are very widespread, so the beekeepers have to use a variety of treatments to try and manage those parasites. But it's pretty much endemic through the entire industry now to have those varroa and tracheal mites present.
Mr. Chair, one additional question. If, given the fact that I think it's
nicotinoids
are an issue and we now have mites, they're an issue, which do you think is more of a threat to the bee population if you were given if you had a gun to your head and you had to pick one? Which one's worse?
Mr. Chair, Senator, the whole issue of colony collapse, I think, is a very complicated one. I'm not sure anybody knows for certain. I think a lot of the brightest minds think it's a combination of pest pressures, pesticides, habitat loss, a lot of different things. Certainly, neonicotinoids is one family of chemistry that is particularly hard on bees, but I don't think anyone can say for absolute certainty that there's one single factor involved. Right. Remember, moving along, a potato inspection. There's two basic programs: shipping point, which is primarily a grading inspection, and then seed potato certification. That's to verify that the potatoes are grown and free of various pests, primarily viruses. And what we do is we do grow outs in the winter to verify the absence of various diseases. Next program is nursery inspection, and again we inspect and certify nurseries, dealers, again to prevent the introduction and spread of various exotic plant pests. We have a phytosanitary export certification program. So what we do is we issue about between 3,000 and 4,000 export certificates each year, and we export for corn and soybean approach about 1 billion pounds primarily to Asian countries. And then we certified 35.7 billion pounds of corn to Western states in the U.S. The next few slides are just kind of some pie graphs that show sort of the breakout of certificates. And you can see Asia by far is one of the biggest recipients of commodities coming from Minnesota. In the next slide, you can see that corn and soybeans is by far the largest by weight, which making up about 50% total of each, and that's on the corn side, that's mainly distillers grain distillates, and then on the soybeans, that's soybean meal. And the next slide is just a little breakout of the various countries, and you can see Taiwan and China.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Friesel, Did I hear you say that the majority of the beans is meal and the majority of the corn is distillered grains for export?
For the ones that we inspect for...
For what you expect.
For phytosanitary purposes.
Okay, sir. Thank you.
So the next section, I'm going to talk a little bit about the programs that are funded either by general funds, LCCMR, or federal grants. And the breakdown is for general funds, we get about $1.8 million. We received about $620,000 from LCCMR, and then federal grants about $1.4 million. So these funds fund a variety of pest detection and programs. We enforce quarantines and regulatory enforcements. Some examples, we survey wheat, for example, for carnal bunt. By certifying that the wheat grown in Minnesota is free of carnal bunt, that allows market access to EU and Asian countries. Next one just shows a little breakdown of some of the federal grants where we get some funding. Emerald ash borer has traditionally gotten a lot of funding for emerald ash borer in the past, close to $1 million at one time. At the federal level, the funding has really fallen out from EAB. We got $210,000 in the last cycle. We think that will probably disappear in the future. And then you can see there's a few other smaller grants that we've received. We had three LCCMR projects, one for mountain pine beetle, brown marmorated stink bug, and then EAB detection. Some of the surveys that are supported by USDA include surveys for corn in corn for plant pests. EAB done various commodity surveys. We look for carnal bunt, potato cyst nematode, and we also do annual honeybee surveys. We also survey soybeans and other small grains. And some of the LCCMR grants I just mentioned are EAB, spotted winged Drosophila, brown marmorated stink bug, and mountain pine beetle.
What's the level of support from the USDA?
Each year it varies a bit, but total we get about $1.4 million in all the various grants from federal sources. Next page was just sort of a summary of the various surveys we've done in soybeans, corn, potatoes, and small grains. Potato cyst nematode, we've got a lot of work on that. Potato cyst nematode is found in Idaho, and so there's a real danger of those potatoes coming to, or that nematode coming to Minnesota. And by verifying the absence of potato cyst nematode here, that opens up a number of markets for Minnesota growers and seed potato growers. Next one is a picture of burning geranium plants. I always like to show this because it's a great example of how international trade has very wide implications. Back in 2003, a lot of nursery stock comes from offshore, either from Africa or Central America. These were geranium plants that were coming from Kenya and Guatemala, and they were found to be infected with a disease called Rostonia, which is it's on the select agent list, and it does not occur in the United States. It's not a big deal as far as geraniums is concerned, but it's a very big deal for potatoes. And so we were able to detect this Rostonia in geraniums, and were able to eradicate it before it became established in the United States. EAB has been a big program for us. As you know, in the news, it's killed millions of trees in the east, again in Michigan. It is now in five counties in Minnesota. We are continuing to survey for it, although we're concerned about the federal funding that has been dropping with each year. Noxious weeds is a small program at the state level.
Could you go back, please, to the emerald ash borer? So we've been testing this, and we're finding out it's migrating throughout the counties. What are we doing with that information? What are we doing preventative wise, and is it working?
Mr. Chair, Senators, Minnesota has had a very aggressive EAB program. We put out about 5,000 traps every year. As you may know, it was first found in Minneapolis and St. Paul. We've worked very closely with those cities. Minneapolis, St. Paul, both I would commend very highly. They have done just a fantastic job in trying to eradicate fines of EAB. Unfortunately, this is an insect that's very difficult to detect. It typically is in trees for many years before you see symptoms. So Minnesota has actually slowed the spread of EAB much better than other states have done, but it is spreading, and it will continue to spread. So we continue to survey. We work with municipalities and counties, but we also have a robust biological control program, and I believe in the long term it's going to have to be a combination of biocontrol and management techniques to address EAB. If there's no more questions on EAB, I'll move on to noxious weeds. We work with counties and townships who provide the primary enforcement part for noxious weeds. We assist the counties with developing educational materials and weed management guidelines. We have a large gypsy moth suppression program. This, again, is largely funded by at the federal level. We've treat an average of about 90,000 acres every year. It's typically up in the northeast part of the state is where we have the biggest infestation of gypsy moth. And we have two new counties that were recently quarantined for gypsy moth, Lake and Cook counties. Biological control, we've been working very hard with that. Some targets have been EAB and then also gypsy moth. For gypsy moth, we've been introducing some fungus that attacks the caterpillars, and then we're introducing some insects to attack leafy spurge, spotted knapweed, and tansy mustard. The next one is a LCCMR project, and this is one that's working with spotted knapweed. We also manage the wolf and elk depredation program, and the current allegation for that is about $200,000. That's one of the change items that I'll be touching on. And then lastly, I just wanted to mention on the programs, we did prepare an industrial hemp report that's been submitted. And with that, I'll move into the change items. So the first one is for wolf elk depredation. So the current allocation is $200,000, and the allocation is allowed to be cross-utilized between either wolf and elk. And so the total claims that we have to date, we had $93,000 in claims for elk. We have $257,000 for wolf, or $350,000 altogether. So that resulted in a shortfall of about $150,000. We did get a Fish and Wildlife Service grant for $80,000, so that reduced shortfall to 70, and just recently we received another $40,000 grant from Fish and Wildlife Service, and that was backdated until October 1, so we were able to pay off an additional $20,000 in claims, so now we have a shortfall of $40,000. The proposed change item would increase the base funding for wolf depredation by $100,000 per fiscal year, or $250,000 for biennium, or $400,000 total for both programs. And this would be no additional staff to the agency. It's just strictly funds that would go for those two programs.
Mr. Chair. So the deprivation program, is you're asking for an increase. Are we going to continue to ask for those dollars specifically for the gray wolf depredation? Obviously, for obvious reasons, we know that the management of those animals are no longer going forward in Minnesota because of a federal rule. So we're continuing to get federal dollars to offset the state's cost here, I would expect.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we last Fish and Wildlife Service grant was for $80,000 for a biennium. This second one we just recently received was half that amount. We get about $40,000, so it has dropped. We don't know from year to year what the long-term sustainability of those funds are. We just apply for it whenever it becomes available to us.
Mr. Chair, if I may, to Senator Ingebrigtsen's point, there is also a federal program called the Livestock Indemnity Program, which is very similar to what MDA does. However, there are two significant differences. One, it's the first time they've done it, so this is something that we've sent out letters to people who've not had their claims paid this fiscal year, that there is this LIP program out through the FSA offices. The two significant differences would be, one, they value the animal differently. At MDA, we value the animal based upon the market loss. So if you're up in Carlstad, Minnesota, and you've got a white-faced Hereford that you're going to sell at $500 when it's at market weight, we base upon, through the University of Minnesota's recommendation, your loss based upon what it would be at market. With the livestock indemnity program takes actual loss that day. So if you lost, let's say, a 100-pound calf, let's just make it simple and say it's $1 a pound, you are only going to be paid 75% of that value. So we cover the full value of market weight. They cover 75% of actual loss. And those are significant differences.
Thank you.
Thank you. And do either one of you gentlemen know, is there any federal or state trapping occurring in the state or going to be occurring in the state this winter?
And Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, the APHIS, USDA APHIS, is maintaining their trappers. And when there are problem areas, they will trap those, and I believe they will remain here in Minnesota.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, and then with regard to the deprivation program, is it the Department of DNR, or who is doing the determination as to if the animal was killed by a wolf or other reasons?
Mr. Chair, Senator, the DNR conservation officers can provide that. It can be a local law enforcement official. It can be a USDA APHIS employee. And recently they added, I think veterinarians are also allowed to make that determination.
So, Mr. Chair, so the Board of Animal Health vets would be allowed to do that also? Is that what I heard?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes. If they're a veterinarian, they would be allowed to. Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Okay, go ahead. The next change item, this is the most significant one of the four that we have within Plant Protection Division. This is the seed permit fee. This fee typically generates about a little over $1 million in annual revenue. And we had our last adjustment back in 2003. And with that last adjustment, we built up a small reserve or carry forward, and that always helps us through the sort of the ups and downs of these types of programs. We have been on a downward spiral of late with we've kept two positions opening that we have not been able to fill, and we've worked very hard with the industry to come up with a new fee structure. The new proposed fee structure is to change how we assess the fee, at least for three of the major crops, for corn, soybean, and sugar beets. We're moving away from a weight-based assessment, but rather go to a seed count assessment, and that is better aligned with how the industry itself works. And so by using this way of determining the fees, which we believe it's going to make it easier for the industry. We're also proposing to restructure how we, on the reporting basis for native or conservation reclamation seeds that are sold in contract quantities. And this is also intended to simplify reporting for seed companies. And this is where we'll have some. These types of seeds have become much more complex over the years because they typically involve a lot of native seeds. And the testing and analysis of these types of seeds is very complex, very time-consuming, and very costly. So we think that this change will better recoup those costs. We did some estimates on what the actual cost to the farmer or the grower would be with these fee increases. We're estimating that the total cost for soybeans is about 7 cents an acre, corn about 8 cents, barley, wheat 7 cents, forage 0.078 cents. And these are all about 2 cents increase from existing fee structure. We hope that if these fee proposal is approved, that we'd be able, therefore, to fill the 2 vacant positions, and we would like to maintain the support that we provide to our laboratory that does the testing, and we'd like to do more work for in specific biotech traits, because that's of growing interest in the state. This, I should mention, we did review this with the Minnesota Seed Advisory Council, and that council is made up of various representatives from ag industry, university, and Minnesota Crop Improvement Association.
So how many people are working currently in this department?
Mr. Chair, the seed program, I believe, has currently 5 staff.
You're trying to get 2 more?
Mr. Chair, yes, there's fill 2 vacancies, yes.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when you talk about this council or committee where you have seed folks involved, do you have consumers involved in that committee at all? Consumers?
Mr. Chair, Senator,
has there never been a need for that, maybe? I don't know.
I don't know if there's ever been a need that we've had. From time to time, we've invited other folks in to talk with us. For example, there's some controversy or questions about seed bank libraries, and so we had some folks from the library and from the private sector come and met with the seed advisory committee. We had a very good discussion. So I guess that's the closest I can think of where we had an actual general public people coming. But typically, it's Farm Bureau, Farmers Union, those kinds of folks that are members of. Of the Seed Advisory Committee. The next change item is a relatively small one. This is our plant export certification fee. Right now we have a 2-tiered system where we have a smaller fee of $75 for anything commodities that are valued at less than $250. And this was intended for people who were sending roses to their aunt in England or something, but then anything where that was $25, where it's $75 for commodities over $250. And we are finding that having this 2-tiered system is really poorly understood, and it's really not used very well. So we just simply like to eliminate the 2 tiers and have a single fee. And so we're proposing to change the fee to just $75 per certificate, and then we would also like to be able to recover costs. Sometimes we have certificates that require a considerable amount of research and work, because the certificates are based on requirements of importing countries, and sometimes those countries have very complex, detailed requirements, and we can spend hundreds of hours of staff time. So we're asking for authority to recover costs when we run into those. They are rather rare instances, but they can be costly, and we would have a cap of $300 on those sorts of fees. We estimate just about a $3,000 increase annually, so it's a relatively small change item. And the last change item is our
$3,000 for the department total,
Mr. Chair. Right, for this for the plant export certification, we think this change will result in about $3,000 is all. And the next and last change item is the nursery law. Probably the most common violation we find is nurseries operating without a license or certificate. We're simply wanting to define that the penalty for doing that is that they have to pay the license that is due plus a penalty that is equal to that license fee. And we also believe that that will produce about $3,000 to $4,000 additional revenue for the program. That's ends my testimony.
And so how often do you have a violation of the nursery program?
How often?
How often, yeah.
Mr. Chair, we typically have about that particular type of violation. There's about 20 to 25 nurseries operating with a license that we find every year. And typically, it's other nurseries that are reporting them to us, and then we follow up on those reports.
What are you going to do with this $6,000 from these two programs?
Mr. Chair, I think it's just really to recover costs. And in the case of the nursery program, it's an added incentive, I guess, to get your license.
It costs you more to print the paper you're giving us. But Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What's the threshold for the requirement to be a licensed nursery? Are we going to have somebody who's in the backyard raising some tomato plants and selling them to their neighbors? What's the threshold for this?
Mr. Chair, Senator, there is a tiered system for the number of acres grown or the dollar value, and then there is an exemption for hobby producers or charitable causes. So those are all exempted, and of course, we would never pursue any kind of enforcement action in those cases.
So, Mr. Do you know what the dollar value would be in order for somebody to be required?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I believe it's a $2,000 is the cutoff for what defines a hobbyist. It's less than $2,000 a year.
Annual,
yes, sir.
It's pretty small.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask about the industrial hemp issue, and only because I'm wondering about it. So that's been talked about as an ag crop, and I get that. I've done a lot of research on it over the years. So tell me if you're going to be inspecting that, something that's not legal federally, how are we going to recover any money for inspection fees? I mean, is that going to be from the private sector? Can you take us through that just real quickly? I hope it's not a got you thing, but I don't want to do that. Or you can come and talk to me about it maybe, but... It's certainly coming forward as a crop.
Right. Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, and as a crop, it does pose a number of complex regulatory questions for us. There's questions about the source of the seed. There's questions about pesticide use on a crop that's not legal. And then there's just the whole DEA aspect. The recent Farm Bill did open the door somewhat for states to pursue hemp production. Generally, hemp is considered, if it has less than 0.3% THC, which, is, of course, is the psychoactive component. And so if hemp production were to go through, I think most states, Colorado is probably the furthest along, they have requirements for testing the hemp to ensure that it's below those particular levels. So,
I guess just wondering, as a finance committee, what are we expecting coming down the line? What does Colorado pay for that? I mean, I don't have a clue. I don't know if members know that, or I wouldn't have a clue.
Mr. Chair, Senator, Colorado has, they had about 200 acres of hemp grown last year, I believe.
Industrial hemp.
They had proposed, the grower had one to grow, I think it was close to 2,000 acres, but wasn't able to secure enough seed. That's been his biggest problem. States are getting DEA permits in Colorado. I believe it's the actual Colorado Department that holds the permit from DEA. In Minnesota, I know the University of Minnesota holds a permit for hemp research. And so that's... Each state is doing it a little differently.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Westphal.
Being the question came up, curious on hemp. You made the statement, is it illegal from the federal government or not? And how do the other states grow it or test it if they do? And I'll mix a second question in. Growing up, I used to bale a lot of hay. And our twine was hemp twine. Where did that come from? Maybe you don't know the answer, but it's related to the question.
Mr. Chair, Senator, and I've certainly walked a lot of cornfields and come across a lot of hemp myself. And until recently, the federal government still defines cannabis as a regulated drug, and that it is a quandary for the states. But it was the Farm Bill, the last Farm Bill, did open a crack for the doors, a crack for the states to begin doing some research into hemp production. And hemp was a common fiber used back in World War II for making rope, cheap source of fiber. So Canada is, I believe, one of the few countries that has legal hemp production, but it has not, it's not a huge amount of production in that country either.
I have a question related to that, and I don't know anything about it. But so it's the percentage of THC, but so is it a kind of a moving percentage, or is there absolutely this is hemp and absolutely this is marijuana? Is there a variation in between?
Mr. Chair, Senator, that is part of the the challenge. I mean, there's a legal definition on the percent, what's saying the difference between hemp and marijuana. But there are gradations of different varieties, and if you're growing marijuana, you're going to pursue higher levels, obviously, of THC. So
that's the law in Norway.
That's
okay.
Norway doesn't have any flat land.
They don't have any flat land.
Beer only, I think.
Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I think we'll go a little bit out of order just to get our two largest divisions as far as asks within the governor's budget taken care of today, at least. So I would ask that the Deer and Food Inspection Division come up, Dr. Ben Miller and Dr. Nikki Kneeser, to present on their change items. They are significant, and in doing so, going through their change items, they will pretty much cover the gamut of an overview for what their division does.
Okay.
I think that's probably all we'll get through today.
Unless we let you go overtime.
We would welcome that.
Gear.
Go ahead. Who wants to go first? Just say your name for the record, and then go ahead and start.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senators. My name is Dr. Nikki Kneeser, and I manage the Department of Agriculture's meat and poultry inspection programs, the dairy inspection program, and the commercial feed unit. So I'm going to talk about those programs. And since I have change items for all those, I'll do them all at the same time, each one. So I'm going to start with the meat and poultry inspection program, and there's a handout that looks like this for that. It's like six slides. It says meat and poultry right on top. All right. So the state of Minnesota has a what's called a Minnesota Equal Two Meat and Poultry Inspection Program, and that program, the Equal Two words mean that that's equal to the USDA Food Safety Inspection Service Meat Inspection Program, and that allows products and processors who are under that program to be wholesaled to through farmers markets, through convenience stores, grocery stores, and that kind of thing within the state of Minnesota. So this is a program that we receive 50% funding from USDA for. So every dollar the state gives from, and that's general fund funding for this program, the USDA matches that. We also, as part of that match, we have to meet very specific standards in order to continue to receive that match. You can see on the slide I have a map of Minnesota on there, and that map has about 20 or 22 little dots on it, and those are meat or poultry processors that are waiting to get onto the meat and poultry inspection program. They are in various stages of readiness for the program. And the reason they're not on the program is because we don't have inspectors to inspect their products or their facilities. So the first change item then is a request to increase the general fund appropriation for the meat and poultry inspection program by $250,000 so that we can hire inspectors to inspect these facilities.
So, Mr. Chair, if I could just clarity for Senator Westrom and I, with the map, the clarity on the map there, it's getting to the point where I've not been able to read this fine print here anymore. I don't know what that's about. It must be the cold weather. But can you tell me what I see Evansville, Glenwood, and Starbuck on there? Senator Westerman and I are inquiring as to what that is about again.
Mr. Chair and Senator, yes, those are there are meat facilities in those towns that are waiting for to get onto the Equal to Inspection program. So they're waiting for an inspector, basically.
Could you explain for the Senator how it works that in order to do business, they need to have someone there?
Sure.
Throw Chisholm in there, too.
Yeah.
In Minneapolis.
I'll add that just a little bit of background on how it works is that in order to do business and wholesale your meat products, you have to have an inspector present for slaughter for every animal that's slaughtered. And so they have to be there all day during that slaughter process. Or for processing, which is basically making ham, sausage, those kinds of traditional products, an inspector has to go there at least once a day. And you can see on my handout on the bottom left-hand corner, there's a graph that shows inspection frequency. So the target we're given for that is 90% by USDA. We have to meet 90%. And we're even with our existing plants, we're falling slightly below our 90% target. And that's for processing inspection. For slaughter inspection, it's 100%. We don't have an option on that. So we have to have, if they're going to slaughter an animal under inspection, there has to be an inspector there.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the locker plant in small town wants to slaughter and sell the meat at their meat counter. Do you have to have an inspector there every day when they're slaughtering? Is that what I heard you say?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, there's a complex, different kinds of operations that they can have. But the slaughter of that animal, for them to sell it anywhere, has to be done under either USDA inspection or state equal to inspection. So if they're going to sell that out of their retail counter, that it has to be sourced from that. It might not be at their own plant, but it has to be a plant.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, I think I'm clear on this, but I want to make sure. But if they're doing a custom process for a farmer to take home, then they don't need anything like that.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, that is correct.
Thank you. Senator Westrom.
So, Mr. Chair, I'm just curious, is that strictly a federal regulation, or have we imposed some of those rules ourselves? And how long has that been the case? And I'm trying to think, I mean, if it's good enough for the farmer to slaughter, which I'm not proposing we would do that, but every animal, every chicken, every cow, every pig, I mean, it seems like that's pretty extensive. But how long has it been, or has it been a time 10 or 20 years ago where maybe it was more like the processing where an inspector could drop in any time of the day, but they didn't have to be there for every chicken?
Mr. Chair, Senator, those are requirements are set by the Federal Meat Inspection Act, and so okay. those provisions have been in place since the early 1900s.
Oh, really?
Okay. So that's been many, many years.
Been forever.
Yes.
Okay. So why is there nothing in northwestern Minnesota and nothing in southwestern Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, we do have existing plants under inspection in northwestern Minnesota. We don't have any in southwestern Minnesota. Those are also areas of the state where there's not a lot of meat processing plants. They just don't have a lot. But I will add that, for example, in southwestern Minnesota, we have had plants show interest, but when they come to us and we say, well, we don't have an inspector in that area to give you until we have enough plants show interest to keep that person busy, they usually pursue other avenues or decide that it's not worth their time.
Well, thank you. But this map with these dots, these are just new applications. There could be existing facilities in the Northwest that just aren't on the map, right?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, that is correct.
Very good clarification. Thank you. Okay, go ahead.
All right, I'm going to move on to the dairy inspection program. So the next three that I'm going to talk about change items are dairy general fund appropriation increase, dairy program lab sampling and dairy farm inspection fee increase. The dairy inspection program does inspections of dairy farms, tankers, haulers, dairy processing plants, ice cream manufacturers, basically everything from the farm to the manufacturer. And this is a very important program for food safety as well as for commerce. So we participate in the National Conference of Interstate Milk Shipments, which requires us to meet certain inspection standards in order for grade A products, which is fluid milk, yogurt, to be shipped into other states. So if the program is not able to meet inspection frequencies, that impacts our industry plants that ship milk into other states. So the change items are meant to be taken basically as a package. The three items are intended to fill a projected budget gap. These items aren't intending to hire new staff. They're basically to fund existing staff. We are projecting, you can see on the chart on the first slide, projecting up close to $800,000 deficit in at the end of fiscal year 2017, and it's projecting to be much higher in the out years. You can see those numbers on the slide, as well as to note that this program has a portion of funding that it receives from the general fund, as well as the dedicated fees that it receives from farm inspection fees, procurement fees, processor fees, and that kind of thing. So the first proposal is just a general fund increase of $200,000. The second proposal is a general fund request for $150,000 to support our laboratory work that is required by the pasteurized milk ordinance in order to meet those standards for shipping products into other states. And that will help us support our laboratory in doing that work. And then the third proposal is a dairy farm inspection fee increase, which goes to our dedicated funds or our revenues, our service account. And that will help us bring the farm inspection fee more closely in line with the actual cost of performing an inspection. So on that slide, you can see in the bottom left, we're looking to recover roughly 60% of the cost of doing an actual farm inspection, and that ends up being $150 per year for a farm. That covers two inspections for grade A farms, and an increase to a $75 fee for grade B farms, which covers one inspection. Again, we're looking for a 60% support level on this, because the program is general fund funded and dedicated fund funded.
Mr. Chair.
All right.
Thank you. I think you must be on the grade A farm inspection cost analysis. I'm looking at the number of farm inspections per year. Can you tell me what the trend is on those and what the numbers were the last few years?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, we're down to around 3,500 farms in Minnesota. And so you can see last year's number, we were at about 7,786 inspections. So that would include new farm inspections. It doesn't include re-inspections. That's a separate fee. But this is just generally routine inspections that we do. So that covers grade A farms are twice a year, grade A or grade B are once a year.
And, Mr. Chair, does the size of the farm have any relationship to the cost of the inspection?
Mr. Chair, Senator, we proposed a flat fee increase. The reason for that is because we find that the size of the farm doesn't have any impact on the cost of our inspection, that small farms frequently take just as long as the large farms and oftentimes more inspections, just depends on their level of compliance. A small farm can be equally out of compliance as a large farm.
Mr. Chair, my thought on it is you're going to be back again in 3 years with the same problem, because the number of small farms continues, in my opinion, to decline. We've struggled in Minnesota to maintain these dairy farms, but the general trend is to bigger and fewer. And I think that I look at the fee increases that are coming along, and they were in some of the other areas too. I mean, we're going to have to start thinking about these things in a different frame. I know that for the potato inspection program that my farm is involved in, I've been encouraging them to partner up with North Dakota, because otherwise it's not going to be able to be economically maintained as the number of seed potato farms continues to decline. So to just come along, you know, and we can do this year, but I think we're going to have to start looking at how we're going to do these inspections so that they just aren't tied to the number of farms that they're going to, because that number is getting smaller and smaller as it goes along. And I would expect that this would, you know, what I'm saying isn't news to you, and I would guess it's a concern, but we're going to have to start figuring out how we address it.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That brings up a couple of issues, Senator Scoy. The farms are getting smaller, but the acreage are not reducing. Are they reducing acres, the big, larger farms?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator, my think on the dairy is that the farms are having more animals. There's just fewer of them. So we're, you know, producing somewhat comparable amount of milk maybe, but it's less people, less farm sites doing it. I know in Clearwater County there used to be, there's probably 30 dairy farms. I don't think there's any left. There might be one. It's just a trend. All those small little dairy farms that raised a family and sent kids to school and, you know, on to college, those kids didn't come home to dairy farm. They went off and did something else.
Senator Scoy, I think we may need a general fund appropriation here.
Well, I don't know what the answer is, but it's a issue that we're going to have some conversations about. That might be one solution, but, you know, maybe they need to rethink about their strategy for assessing the fees, too.
Thank you. And, you know, I guess we can have that discussion, and then you're right. I think the corporate farmers are getting to be bigger and bigger, smaller. I mean, our small towns are reflecting that with the populations and that just the ongoing education, feeing and funding and all, everything. But my question would be then overall, what's the percentage of fee increases here in this budget overall? I'm sure it's on a page here, but what overall fee increase are you asking for all the area and the dairy and food inspection division?
Mr. Chair, Senator, for the entire division?
Yes.
We can get that for you,
Senator. Would you please? Thank you.
Do you have a dollar amount?
I can get that for you as well, Chair.
To the committee, maybe.
Air gating it.
Is it on one of these sheets?
No, not on one of these sheets, Chair.
Okay, go ahead, Doctor.
Right, Mr. Chair, Senators, I'm going to move on to the feed tonnage inspection fee, and I'm going to talk about that as well as the feed tonnage payer change. So we also have a commercial feed inspection program, which functions to protect the animal food supply, make sure that it's safe for animals to consume, and then also has a function to provide an equal and consistent playing field for the feed manufacturers in terms of an economic kind of thing. This program is 100% supported by fees, primarily the tonnage fee that we're discussing here. The current minimum payment for that fee is $10 per year, and the current fee is 16 cents, and we are asking to increase that fee to 26 cents. The feed program fund balance projections are also trending very negative in out into fiscal 18, fiscal 19. We are requesting to increase this fee this year because of the time lag that it takes to get this fee implemented. By the time the next biennium rolls around, it will be too late to accommodate or get that fee implemented in time to be effective. The feed program also has a couple big changes coming, specifically the Food Safety Modernization Act and what's called the Animal Feed Regulatory Program Standards, which is our standards that the Food and Drug Administration are holding programs to that accept federal contract money in terms of training and inspection procedures and processes. So we're anticipating additional requirements on the program, and so this fee, the increase in this fee is also intended to address that issue.
When you say the current minimum payment is $10 per year, is that a level payment, not counting the 16 cents per ton or whatever? Or what is the $10? What
Mr.
is the
$10 Chair,
minimum?
Mr. Chair, that's the minimum. That's the current minimum you could pay if you go underneath what the 16 cents would justify. And that was implemented.
So the 16 cents is a per ton fee. Is that what it is?
Correct.
Okay. And so how much are you going to raise by increasing your fee?
The fee increase is projected to raise around $1 million, and I believe that the change item in that packet is not correct, and I believe it says $500,000 in the original budget change items that were produced. So it is projected to raise around $1 million.
Okay.
Change item I'm going to talk about is the feed tonnage fee payer, and this is a change in how we would apply this fee. This request is intended to address some problems we found on audits of the feed tonnage payers. When we've been doing our audits, we found 72% of our audits have paid the wrong amount, and that is because there's a lot of confusion on who is to pay the fee and at what point in the process this fee is to be paid.
How long have we been paying the wrong amount?
These audits have been going for 3 or 4 years. So this is the first that we've detected that.
And are they paying less than they should or more?
Mr. Chair, they're paying both, more and less than they should.
So we're turning out okay then.
Mr. Chair, yes, we're evening out. Yes. For MDA, this change would really be fee neutral. In fact, we expect we may have a small reduction in fees as a result of this change. To put it most simply, that the new language would require that the fee, instead of being paid by the first person in the distribution model, it would be paid by the last person in the distribution model. The person or the firm that last distributes feed to a farmer or a retail store. The way it is now, it's the first company that distributes feed into Minnesota, and after that point, that feed could be distributed to another distributor or another mill or various different places, and so it's always the first person. This change would also make us more consistent with most other states, and so we anticipate that would eliminate some of the confusion that we're seeing on the audits.
So who's going to like this and who isn't?
Mr. Chair, there will obviously be some people who are not paying fees now. I would anticipate that some feed mills may right now be the last in the distribution chain, and they don't pay the fee, and they may have to pay the fee going forward. Whereas people who are distributors potentially who are distributing into the state and are that first person, they're going to go to a feed mill. They're now paying the fee, and they may not pay the fee if with this change.
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Why not have, I mean, as with the checkoff, it's the first handler that pays the checkoff. Why would you not have the first handler paying this fee as opposed to the last handler?
Mr. Chair, Senator, that is how the law currently is that the first handler is paying the fee. Unfortunately, that's not consistent with what other states are doing, and so feed companies are, you know, distributed into multiple states, and so they're confused by that and are paying the wrong amounts. And so in order to be more consistent, we propose to make this change to that fee.
Okay. Mr. Chair and Senator, I believe we're one of only four states. I don't know the names. I can get them for you. I think we're only one of four states that collects it this particular way, the way it currently is.
I mean, we do it the right way, and nobody else does.
Well, Mr. Chair, you're going to hear from all those small feed people that are now going to start paying a fee.
That's why I asked who wouldn't like it. Okay. All right. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Sorry.
Just the clarification to make sure I got the dairy farm inspection fee. And that's a doubling of the fee. Did I gather that? You're $1 million increase in the... And the total revenue is 1.9, so it's a doubling.
Mr. Chair, Senator, on the dairy farm inspection fee,
yes.
the grade A farm inspection fee would be moving from $50 to $150.
It's a tripling.
The grade B would be from $25 to $75. For the program, that generates about $320,000 the first year, and as you pointed out, as the number of farms decline, that amount of projected revenue would decline also.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Very impressed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm assuming your presentation is done. If it is, if it's not, that's fine. But I guess what we would, or I certainly would expect the numbers, the percentages, because that's the question that's going to be asked when it comes to budgeting. The percentage of increase in fees. Now, there's a, you know, we can have this talk all day long, taxes versus fees, but nevertheless, it's there. It's never going away. If fees are, you know, fee-based, I get fees. I understand that. But we need to know what the increases are when we move forward, because if we don't know that, it's going to be asked, and I think it's going to be asked quite often. So if we just would get that information to the committee, it would be great.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, that's a very good point. We'll get you the aggregated. However, I would ask for your attention to detail in the sense that, you know, when you look at the fee, the tonnage fee, that's going from a $10 minimum up to a $100 minimum. So there we have a huge percentage increase. However, if you adjusted for inflation from the last time that particular fee was changed in 1925, we'd be going to about $140. So we were asking people to pay more percentage-wise before the Depression than we are now. So to some degree, if you look at the percentages, and we'll get those to you, you do also have to look at the individual fees and when the last time they were changed. You know, that type of attention.
Mr. Chair, and I certainly understand that. The bottom line is somebody's going to have to, I mean, that's a good explanation, but just have it on a simple document as the last time it was increased. And if we're not keeping with it, we should be. I mean, it just seems like we should be. And, of course, the fees are being paid. They're going to be paid by the consumer. We all know that. I mean, eventually, I would assume that the producer is going to pass that along. So we just need to know.
Let me see if I understand your chart here, because it says firms that pay the minimum, there's 398 of them. So they pay $10 a year, and you raise $3,980 from those people. You're now going to raise $39,800. Is that correct? And then the 258 firms that pay more than the minimum, they pay several million. Is that correct? Or?
Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct. They pay the majority of the fees that we collect.
And so these firms that pay the minimum, they're very small farms, or what are they?
Mr. Chair, yes, they're very small distributors of feed, doing very small amounts, and not, you know, fewer than, they don't even have to pay $10, you know, in that 16 cents per ton, so.
Right. So of the 258 firms that paid more than the minimum, are they all across the board there? Or are there some that are paying huge fees and some are just paying just barely over the $10? Or?
Mr. Chair, we could get you the distribution model. Most of those firms are paying a lot of fees. There's not many firms that are on that line.
And so are we increasing the 16 cents? I don't see that anywhere.
That's not on the overall this chart, but the fee increase on the change item is from 16 cents to 26 cents.
Okay. All right. Okay. Anybody else?
Mr. Chair, and I would just add I'm sorry.
Senator Dietzick, go ahead.
I have questions on, I think, what was going to be the next discussion, so I was going to ask if we're going to come back Wednesday or what's the plan here.
Are you talking about which one?
So there's a proposal to regarding delegated facilities and some coordination with Department of Health. And it's some change items, I believe, and increasing some fees. And so part of my question is just for some clarity. And then
we're going to say something here.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Cruz.
If I may, we do have Dr. Ben Miller here. He was going to cover in brief the other part. Dairy and food inspection division also covers retail and wholesale food. And that was going to be the second half, though I think we could do it in a relatively short period of time here today, so we don't have to bring
15 minutes?
Yes.
Ken? Okay. Go
ahead. Mr. Chair, Senators, thank you. Dr. Ben Miller, I manage our food inspection and response program at Department of Ag. Briefly, we inspect grocery stores, food manufacturers, convenience stores, facilities like that. We don't do restaurants. That's Department
Why don't you pull your microphone a little closer to you?
Is that better?
Yeah.
Thank you. So I will very quickly go through each one of these change items. And just as brief background, food inspection right now is currently funded 100% through general fund, the direct food inspection activities, at about $3.5 million per year. So that's about 66 cents per year per citizen of the state of Minnesota. The first change item on your slide set handouts is titled Retail Food Safety Unified Regulation. This is a joint proposal that we have with the Minnesota Department of Health that would look to create a single license structure, or a similar license structure between Department of Ag and Department of Health, that would be based on the complexity of the inspection or otherwise on the risk of the processes that are occurring within a food facility. And those classifications, risk classifications, are currently defined in state statute. They also define the inspection frequency for inspections: once a year for high-risk facilities, 18 months medium risk, 24 months low-risk facilities. So this proposal would move away from what is currently a licensing model that we use at the health or at the Department of Ag, based on the amount of food sales a facility or business conducts, to a more of a complexity-based model to better align with the time that it takes to do the inspection work. This proposal would also dedicate the license fees that are collected for that activity. A similar proposal, if you turn look at the manufactured wholesale food license proposal, we also license and inspect wholesale food facilities. Those would be like food warehouses or food manufacturers. So companies like General Mills, Malto Meal, things like that within the state that manufacture food in Minnesota. This proposal would align the license structure similarly as we would with retail, making it complexity-based license structure based on risk classification, again, and dedicate the funds for those activities. If you note on both of those slides, there's an inspection frequency graph. The primary reason that we're asking for more resources to complete this work is that because we are unable to meet the current inspection frequency that's in statute. So right now, about between 30 and 40% overdue on inspections at facilities. And these proposals correlate to a commensurate or proportional increase in staffing to do these activities. So if you've had questions about the total fee increases for each one of these proposals, it would be $1.2 million for the retail food proposal, $1.5 million for the manufactured and wholesale food proposal. Dr. Neisser mentioned the Food Safety Modernization Act. This is going to be a significant change in the way that food is inspected and regulated within the United States, and that's not unique to Minnesota, but it will take more resources in terms of inspection time from our staff. The next change item is the retail food handler plan.
Senator Dietzig, is this what you wanted to ask?
Well, I have a lot. I mean, I have got specific questions in there, getting there. It's the last slide is one of them. But so are you going to hire three FTEs for this process? And I'm confused because my understanding is you're going to be doing some coordinating with MDA. So Ag and Health are going to do some coordination. And is this kind of all of what you're talking about? Because in here you're talking, you know, one person to coordinate this project, but in the write-ups you're talking three. And then what is the actual, is it like a $35 fee? Is it based on the size, or is it just a straight fee increase? And then I've got additional questions once you get to the delegated authority one.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Senator, I'll go through and finish, and then we can kind of address your question.
Sure.
The retail food handler plan review fee is a fee that's currently assessed to retail licensees that do major remodeling or new construction for their facility, and it's essentially the review of the construction plans to make sure that the equipment that's being installed is up to code. This proposal would bring those fees more in line with the delegated agencies that we delegate our inspection authority to, which would bring me to the next change item, which is the delegated food inspection program change item. This one is a proposal that would assess a $15 fee. So it's a $15 fee to every licensee that the Department of Ag licenses, as well as every licensee that falls under the delegation agreement that we have with seven local public health entities that conduct retail food inspection work on behalf of the department. So we have seven agencies that do that, primarily in the Twin Cities metro area, two counties, five cities. So this proposal would assess a $15 fee to their licensees as well, and those entities would then remit that fee back to the department to ensure that we have adequate oversight of those programs. When delegation was first put into statute back in the late 90s, the department wasn't allocated any specific resource for the oversight of those delegation agreements. Since then, I believe in 2006, the health department's put in place a similar program that generates about $700,000 in revenue for them, and they staff 8 people to oversee their delegation agreements. They have more. They have in the low 30s. We have 7. We're proposing that we would have 1 FTE that would assist with the oversight of those programs, as well as develop educational and outreach material for the retail food industry, so that would cover the entire state in addition to the work that's done overseeing those delegation programs. The last change item that we have is the canning case fee assessment. This proposal would change the maximum fee paid by commercial canneries in Minnesota from $6,000, which when it was last updated in 2001, to $12,000. And that is based on a half cent that's charged for every case of canned product produced. Primarily, this is done to recover costs for inspections. We conduct 3 to 4 inspections at each one of these major commercial canneries during the canning season, pre-operational inspection, and then 2 or 3 inspections during the course of their production run. And it's similar in some respects to some of the dairy assessment fees that are out there. It's essentially a cost recovery for that inspection work. And primarily there, we're concerned with making sure that they've got adequate controls in place to prevent against an organism concern. In that case would be botulism. And, we have seen cases nationally where associated with canned products, at least within the last 5 to 7 years. There are 13 licensees that pay that fee right now, that pay that some fee. 10 of those pay the full $6,000 currently. So, and of those 10, it would be likely that the 10 would also pay the $12,000. Thank you. I know that was quick. But
answer Senator Dietzick's question.
Mr. Chair, no, we didn't get into. Are you doing 1 staff to coordinate, or are you doing 3 staff? Is it $15 for everyone across the state? Because as I'm reading the summary, what is confusing on the delegated agency program, and I'm looking for the exact language here. It's talking about the funding would support outreach and education training opportunities for all retail food businesses in Minnesota. So are you charging this fee to all retail food businesses in Minnesota, or just the delegated authorities? And then do you direct bill all of those retail industries, but you're expecting these 17 or these 7 delegated agencies to do the billing for you? I'm confused, and I think the delegated agencies are also confused.
Mr. Miller.
Mr. Chair, Senator, $15 assessed to every license holder, if that's an MDA license holder or a license holder that falls under the delegation agreements, the local public health entities. And the expectation is that, yes, they would collect that fee and remit that fee or whatever, whatever their share of that would be back to the department. So that if they have 10 facilities, it would be $150 that would come back to the department. And, yes, to answer your question, it would be 1 FTE for that proposal. The other proposal that you referred to, the retail food unified regulation proposal, would be 1 FTE for, I believe, 2 years for the Department of Ag that would assist with determining further alignment between Department of Ag and Department of Health as our work relates to retail food inspection. So it's an attempt between both agencies to recognize and reduce redundancy, make operations more efficient. We both regulate using the same food code, Minnesota Rule 4626. So the effort there is to make sure that we're conducting our work in a very similar fashion, and that there's no inconsistency between both agencies.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I think that is somewhat helpful. I would suggest that you coordinate a lot more with the health department and with the local agencies, because I believe there's a lot of confusion and a lot of overlap. And I think I understand and agree that there are, more and more inspections are needed, and that it, appears clearly, I'm reading this, that you're not keeping up. And there are probably a lot of new, restaurants. And then there's some complexities on, is the, the restaurant also have a bakery. And so there's a lot of overlap. But I think you need to bring in these delegated agencies, because I think they also are feeling there's not consistency between what you're doing, what MDH is doing, and then just as you move forward, I would suggest that you bring them in. Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Doctor, the fee from 2001 figure, could you give me that again? In 2001, they were making was $6,000, and that's going to go to what now?
Mr. Chair, Senator, it was $6,000 maximum, so that was the maximum fee that would be charged. This would be going from $6,000 to $12,000, so it would be doubling that fee. In 1991, that fee was $3,000. In 2001, it doubled to $6,000, just for historical.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, but just to clarify, yes, that is the cap, but if you are somewhere between, because again, it's assessed on a per case basis, a half cent. So if your production level is somewhere between what, 6,000 divided by whatever a half a cent would be, that many cases, and you do the same math of the 12,000, it's not automatic that everybody who's currently paying 6,000 would move up to 12,000, because it depends upon their production level.
So those that are making 6,000 now will go to what on this proposal?
It would depend, Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, it would depend on their independent and particular production level. So they would know based upon how many they do whether or not they would hit the ceiling again. But as far as the way the statute is written, it's merely saying that after a certain level, we're no longer recovering our costs. So at $6,000 currently, we're no longer recovering our costs, but we're still doing the work. That would move to $12,000, which is to say, if you are producing enough to justify $12,000, then at that point you would no longer have to pay anymore. But if you're somewhere between the $6,000 current cap, and if it gets put into law, the $12,000 cap, you're not automatically doubling. It would depend upon what your production level is, because again, it's a per case assessment on your production level.
Do you guys actually sit around and think about all this stuff?
My question is, are any of them going to double?
I can find out for you.
Please.
Okay. Any other comments or questions from this group? Okay. You can come back on Wednesday, finish this up.
Yeah, we will be, we have three other divisions, Chair, and we will be going through those three divisions then.
Could you like make us charts of what the fees are, mm-hmm. What they're going to, and how much they will generate so that we can see it pretty simply, and maybe say when the last time it was raised and et cetera, okay?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Mr. Carbo, did you want to say anything today, or you want to wait till?
Well, it's up to you. I mean, my remarks are brief, and they're based on this this.
And where are you? Why don't you go up and say what you have to say? Thank you.
Sorry. Mm-hmm. Do you see my legacy? No.
Okay.
The only legacy.
Just say your name for the record. And then
absolutely. My name is Jamie Poole. Mr. Chairman, I'm the president of the Minnesota Grocers Association, and I'm here today to talk to you the Governor Dayton's budget proposals that you just heard about from the Department of Agriculture, Dairy, and Food Inspection Division. Just as a refresher, the Minnesota Grocers Association is a trade association. We've been representing the food industry in Minnesota for over 117 years. We have over 200 retail members with nearly 1,100 stores statewide and approximately 100 wholesale and manufacturer partners. Our member companies employ 125,000 union and non-union Minnesotans, and we are the backbone of Minnesota's economy. We have a very unique culture in Minnesota of small, independent, and locally owned grocery and convenience stores. We are the home to an abundant array of food manufacturers. They create jobs, support local charities, provide safe and responsible shopping experience. As an industry, our number one priority is to provide a safe and a responsible shopping experience. We have a deep commitment to going above and beyond to ensure that we are manufacturing, purchasing, selling the safest possible products. We invest in third-party audits. We hired food safety specialists. We create a culture where associates are given the necessary tools to keep our facilities, stores, and products safe. This is just a small sampling of the voluntary activities we do. Even as the State Trade Association, we are involved in working with USDA and FDA and making sure that recall notices go out to our retail partners, again, to reiterate the importance of food safety. As you heard today, the governor's budget recommendations for the Department of Dairy, Food and Dairy Inspection Division includes millions of dollars of new and increased fees on all areas of the supply chain from farm to fork. We are deeply concerned about these recommendations and some of the fundamental changes to the structure that we're seeing with the department. These recommendations are placing the burden of funding on the division on the food industry of Minnesota through this dedicated funding mechanism. We are also deeply disappointed that with a $1 billion budget surplus, the governor does not seem that the food safety supply chain is a priority. As Minnesotans have an expectation that their food is safe, and to eliminate the general fund dollars does not make sense. To completely restructure an entire division when we have not been brought to the table and had stakeholder engagement about the fee structure and how to get there doesn't make sense. And to put all of this additional financial pressure on the food supply chain from farm to fork doesn't make sense. We've always appreciated a collaborative approach in working with the department. We are an industry. We hold multiple positions on the governor's food safety task force. We have been instrumental in working diligently over the past decade to update the Minnesota Food Code. We work aggressively to educate our partners to make sure, again, that we are providing safe food for Minnesotans. We all share a common goal, and we strongly believe that maximizing, not diminishing, these partnerships will bring the best outcome for successes. We know that there's a lot of challenges that the legislature will face this session as members address the budget surplus. Many difficult decisions have to be made to create a balanced budget that is fiscally and socially responsible and that handles the pressures of the constituencies. The retail food industry typically operates on a profit margin of around 1%. Like the legislature, the food industry of Minnesota, with increasing cuts and shrinking profit margins, also faces difficult decisions in its bottom line. The proposal this committee has heard will raise millions of dollars of fee increases on the entire food industry, which will ultimately put the burdens on Minnesota's kitchen table. As you move forward in this progress, we ask that you consider the ramifications. We're happy to be a resource, and I'm pleased to stand for questions. Thank you for your time.
Okay. Mr. Cruz, you may want to talk with these people if you haven't talked with them yet. Sounds like you haven't.
That is incorrect. We have met personally several times. We have a two-week scheduled meeting with them standing at the department, so that would be inaccurate.
So you are going to be meeting with them, is that what you said?
I have and I will.
Okay, all right. Okay, because we should probably get some agreement on all of this stuff. That'd be a good idea. It'd make it easier for the committee to recommend funding levels.
And Mr. Chair, just a one paragraph here. I would say is we don't relish raising these fees. We understand
it's
difficult.
Either.
And we know that it's unpopular. I would just say that with respect to raising fees in the agricultural world, it's important for this committee to understand that farmers are price takers, not price setters. And so when we look at the whole panoply of fees that are raised within this division, there may be 1% in the retail world, and that is a difficult profit margin. But when we look at what we're doing with the dairy industry, and that's not an easy decision either, they're below the cost of production. Corn is below the cost of production. So we are coming from a place of real need. We are looking to work with as many people as possible. We have reached out and met with as many people as are representing these groups, and we'll continue to work with them, but we are not coming from a place of these would be nice to have. We are definitely coming from a place we need to have this for food safety in Minnesota.
Okay, we'll keep reaching and keep talking, okay? All right.
Absolutely.
Thank you all very much. Meeting adjourned.